Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the RPM sub-team for URS providers call held on Wednesday, the 13th of June, 2018 at 1200 UTC. On today's call, we have Kathy Kleiman, Philip Corwin, Michael Karanikolas, Justine Chu, Aditya Singh from the Asian International Arbitration Center. We have apologies from Carrie Shang. From staff, we have Arielle Yang, Julie Hedlund, Barry Kopp, and myself, Andrea Glandon. I would like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I will turn it back over to Arielle Yang. Please begin.
Thanks so much, Andrea, and welcome, everyone. I noticed that, Susan, you have your hand raised, and I will turn over to you shortly. But just before we start, I want to remind everyone that we have got the responses from the three providers on Friday at COB by the deadline we set for them, and most of the questions have been answered, and then forum has about 20 questions. They need a little bit more time to provide responses, and they're hoping to provide the responses by before ICANN 62. And then the spreadsheet was circulated yesterday, about 24 hours ago, and for the color coding, you see on the document, the light orange cells are the questions that we sent to the providers, and then the dark orange cells contain attachments or additional documents accompanying the responses from the provider. And then the bright yellow ones are the ones forums still haven't responded, and they're hoping to respond by ICANN 62. So that's a quick overview of this document, and then as you see, it's a lot of text and information, and probably need the sub-team's guidance how we're going to digest this information. So I will stop now and then turn over the floor to Susan. Susan, please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Ariel. It's a point I just made in the chat, but I want us to progress our work, and I'm not necessarily suggesting we stop this call, but I'm quite concerned that, you know, we have 10 members of this sub-team, and there are only three of us here. I'm excluding from that count Kathy and Phil, who are sort of on top of the volunteer sub-team members. But, you know, we've got hardly anyone on this call. We also have this, you know, a document that came around yesterday, and I mean, thank you very much for circulating it. But I think, you know, I think this is part of the problem. You know, if people are not getting documents very far in advance of what looks like being a lengthy call, I think that in itself is a discouragement to joining if you feel like you're not prepared. But also, you know, kind of not really having a great deal of notice of a call is another reason why people are not free. You know, generally speaking, we kind of expect our RPM's calls to be at certain times of the day, and this one isn't at that time. And so, again, I'm not necessarily saying we stop, but I just think, you know, we need to be giving people a bit more notice of calls, and we need to be we need to be thinking about whether we can proceed if we don't really have anyone present.
Thanks very much.
This is Phil. Let me weigh in, and then maybe we can get Kathy's input. By the way, I want to say, Ariel, I did find the document you sent yesterday. You know, I get like 50 to 100 emails a day and missed that one. But I didn't miss the one, and this is why perhaps I was confused when I opened the Adobe chat. There was an email yesterday, 1 hour after, just 1 hour after yours, from Julie Bislan saying the call for RPMs, and this one I did read yesterday, the call for RPM sub-team for U.S. providers to review research of Professor Tushnet will take place on Wednesday, 13th June, 2018. At 1200 UTC, which is now. So you sent a document yesterday, and then an hour later, this notice came saying the focus of the call would be reviewing Professor Tushnet's research. So that's, I'm not trying to make excuses of myself, but there was some confusion in terms of what members of the providers group got yesterday in terms of what would be at the meeting. I'll ask Kathy what she thinks. I've now opened the document that was attached to Ariel's email yesterday. I could start going through it. This will be a matter of first impression for me because I missed that email and have not reviewed this prior, but I don't know whether, you know, to Susan's point, there's just a small number of the members of the group here, so I'm not sure whether or not we should proceed. What do you think, Kathy? Can you weigh in?
I share the frustration, Phil. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Always just the first. Yeah, I share the frustration that Susan is voicing, that you're voicing, a lot of emails, a lot of data crossing. I had thought that Rebecca would be on this call, but I don't see her. But as long as we're here, and I don't see doing this for 90 minutes, but let me suggest, it seems like there's at least three items floating around of data for the providers now. One is, Barry, have you circulated, do we have answers to those kind of, weren't there provider questions that you thought Rebecca, the Harvard research, would help address? So that's one question is, do we have answers to that? Because I thought Barry was doing that research. And then we have this spreadsheet and then the Harvard research itself. Is it possible, without diving too deeply, to kind of go over everything broadly so that we can see the format, we can kind of understand what's there? It might help do a deeper dive, you know, spend half an hour kind of just getting the structures of these things to better understand what's in front of us. Don't know, but let me put that out there. Thanks.
This is Erin Leong from staff, and I just want to put myself in the queue and provide some clarifications. So regarding the call time today, in fact, the staff have informed the sub-teams about today's call time last week. I think it was a week ago that we said this call going to happen today, so it was a week notice for this call. And then regarding the question about Professor Rebecca Tushnet's presentation, so we also communicated last week that Professor Tushnet wouldn't be in the call today because she has other engagement and she's actually leading another workshop or a meeting. So that's why we circulated the seven questions staff identified that Professor's Tushnet's data may help provide answers. And then she actually provided answers to these questions. And then that was incorporated in the spreadsheet. The last column wrote additional notes. But staff are happy to just pull out that document where Professor Tushnet's comments are listed there, so it's probably easier for the sub-team to view. So I just want to provide these two comments here.
Yeah, Ariel, this is Phil. You know, we're all on the phone. We probably should do something, but I do want to note, I already noted the email that came from Julie Bisland yesterday, an hour after yours, with the calendar attachment, reiterating that this call is supposed to be reviewing Professor Tushnet's research, and that, in fact, you know, when I checked last night for what my schedule was today, that's what the calendar invite says. It said nothing about reviewing responses from the provider. So there was a real gap here in conveying that the agenda had changed in a way. You know, we've gotten so many emails for this working group in the last couple of days with calendars filling up with meetings day after day, it's gotten somewhat confusing. So what's the sense of the group? Do we want, you know, are we going to go over the providers' responses at all, or is it just, what should we be going over? Susan, do you have a Payne, do you have a view?
Yeah, I did put it in the chat, but I realize it's not easy to follow the chat. Sometimes people aren't in the Adobe.
Yeah, because I'm jumping from an Adobe document that I can read back to the chat.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So I thought I'd just put my hand up. Look, I mean, I know what you say, Phil, about what you thought the meeting was about. I've got to say, I've seen the other side of the coin, so I was expecting to talk about provider responses and only Rebecca's research insofar as it's identified in this document that's up in the screen. I'm not happy if we have an in-depth discussion of Rebecca's research when there's almost no one on this call. I'm really uncomfortable about it. We've never agreed on the...
Yeah, and Susan, I don't want to interrupt, but I'm uncomfortable discussing her research without her on the call.
Well, that too. But I, you know, we've never even agreed on the how we treat Rebecca's research, and to the extent that we're having a conversation about how we treat her research, I think it needs more than a handful of people. I can't remember which provider is on this call, but I think Andrea said at the beginning one of the providers is with us. So perhaps, you know, at the very least, if even if we didn't look at all the provider responses, perhaps we should take the opportunity and the benefit of having one of the providers with us and look at their responses. What do you think about that?
I'm sorry, Susan. I missed the last sentence you said broke up. Could you repeat that?
I just said I think we've got, and someone's confirming in the chat, we've got the AVNDRC, the Asian Domain Name Dispute Provider, with us. So if we do nothing else, we should, I think, take the opportunity to have them with us and maybe go through their responses. What do you think? That seems reasonable?
Yeah, I think that's a good suggestion. So why don't... Why don't we start doing that? I don't know if Justine wants to lead us through the responses, the new material that we haven't seen before, or what the best way is. I don't know if Justine's willing to do that. But that would at least make some use of this time. We've got people up and on the phone. So...
This is Ariel from staff. If we need help, I can help lead through the responses of ADNDRC because...
All right. Well, I'm just... Okay, so I'm trying to read the color coding. So light orange is questions that were sent. Dark orange is responses that include attachments. And it links to them on the last page of the spreadsheet. And bright yellow are remaining questions to be answered that forum aims to answer before 62. Okay, so looking at the document with that as a background, let me bring up the document. All right, so I'm not sure of what's new here from ADNDRC and what we've previously seen. That color coding doesn't seem to deal with that.
This is Ariel. So all the
okay.
Light, all the
light orange are new questions that were sent out.
Yes, and then the responses are next to them. So these are all new.
All right. So starting on page 2, what percentage of any of communications to complainants and registrants are done in ways other than electronically via the Internet? What alternative means are utilized? And the responses in URS proceedings, except as provided in Rule 2, A, communications to complainants or registrants are not done in ways other than electronically. I'm not surprised by that answer. I wouldn't expect anything other than that. I'm putting myself on speaker just so I don't have to hold the phone in my head for the next hour. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you.
All right, so I don't have any comments on that response. Anyone want to raise any questions? It's the response I would have expected. All right. And by the way, I'm working off this big spreadsheet from the Adobe doc, and I'm not seeing, I mean, from, it's an Adobe document, but I'm not in the Adobe room while I'm reading this document. So if anybody, so staff, please, if someone raises their hand, I'm not able to monitor the chat or see hands raised while I'm reading through this document, because I cannot read the document as it's formatted in the chat room. So if anyone, if there's any significant comments or anyone raising their hand, please tell me.
Okay. So staff noted.
Okay. On page 3, which of the two-sided methods in URS Rule 2A do you use to deliver the notice of complaint, including both the hard and electronic copy? What mechanism do you have in place to either method to track actual delivery to a receipt by the respondent? Do you utilize any means to confirm receipt? And ADNDRC has not engaged in the practice of delivering the notice of complaint in hard copy. In the future, and in the view of the GDPR, and in view of the GDPR when it is more difficult to access the registrant's data from WHOIS, it will be more difficult for ADNDRC to engage in means to deliver notices in hard copies. Let me start a discussion here. Justine, GDPR may make it more difficult to see some registrants' information now and in the future. Right now it should only be shielding generally the registration information of natural persons and not legal persons from the EU. We understand that some contracted parties may be going further, but I have to say both of the other providers are complying with the requirements in the current URS to also have delivery, by fax and physical mail. So I don't find this a convincing response for your current practice. I know it's been an issue of concern for other members of the working group that you're not following the rule now, and it seems to me that raising the GDPR and possible future problems is not an excuse for noncompliance now. Did you want to respond to that?
So this is Ariel. Justine has her hand raised.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, this is Justine. Phil, I think I should step in and correct you. I don't actually represent AIAC. I'm not the rep. So I think you're posing the question to the wrong person. Okay.
This is Ariel from staff.
All right, so is someone on this call from ADNDRC? I thought someone was on the call from them.
Yes, this is Ariel from staff, and the secretary person from ADNDRC is shown as KL office, and this person is from Kuala Lumpur office of ADNDRC. And
what is the name of this person?
Hi.
Yeah.
Hi, everyone. This is Aditya Singh from Asian International Arbitrations. We are one of the providers under ADNDRC. So regarding this question, I would like to mention that AIAC office is yet to register a case under URS. So as far as AIAC is concerned, we have not indulged in this practice where we only explicitly send the complaint through the email and not by hard copy. And so I think the proper response would have come from HKIAC, which have registered a large number of URS cases. So I don't think I'm fit enough to answer this question right here.
So you're saying that while you're associated with ADN-DRC, you're not in a position to answer questions regarding these responses. Am I understanding
you
correctly?
So under ADRC, as you must be aware that under ADN-DRC, they have four offices. One is HKISC, Kuala Lumpur, Seoul, and CTAC. So in AISC, as far as AISC is concerned, we have not administered any URS case till now. So I cannot speak on behalf of ADN-DRC. I can only speak on behalf of AISC, which is one of the providers under ADN-DRC.
Okay, so you can only speak on behalf of a provider that hasn't done any URS cases?
Yes. I mean, we have only general opinion. Yes.
All right, well, thank you for being on the call, though. It's not very helpful to us to have someone on the call representing the organization who's unable to respond and shed any light on these responses. Kathy, I see your hand up.
Yes, but let me ask a question anyway. Because you just spoke to it, I apologize. Could you help with the pronunciation of your name again, please?
Aditya.
Aditya. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you. And so here's the question: the rules say a hard copy notice, but yet you say you're not prepared to send one when it comes in. Can I ask why, and can I share that the reason for the hard copy notice is, of course, an email from a party to whom you have no previous relationship often winds up in spam, and that's if you're lucky. Sometimes it's filtered out before it even gets to the spam filter. So the hard copy wasn't designed for, you know, the whole pleading, although in this case it's fairly short, 500 words, but it was designed for actual notice, to come as close to actual notice as possible. So can I ask why you don't do that?
As I mentioned earlier, that we haven't come across as far as AIC is concerned. So this response is cumulative of the ADN-DRC, which includes HKIAC and CEOL and CTAC. So I'm not speaking on behalf of ADN-DRC. I'm speaking on behalf of AIAC.
Okay, so on behalf of your organization, if you get a URS filing tomorrow, why wouldn't you be sending out a hard copy notice?
We would send it out with hard copy.
You would? Okay. And would you send it out in local language?
We would deliver the complaint as it come to us in whatever language it is, be it English. So we'll send out the complaint as it is. Yes.
So if it's going to a registrant in China who's in an internationalized domain name, a Chinese top-level domain, you would send it in Chinese as well? Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Ariel, I see your hand up. Let's hear from Susan. She has her hand up, and then I'll hear from you, and then we can move on to the next question. Go ahead, Susan.
Thank you. Aditya, I wonder if perhaps we could we take a step back, because I think maybe we're all sort of laboring under slight surprise from what you're saying, it seems like there aren't standard rules across the four offices. That we would be collectively calling ADN-DRC. So could you just please explain how it works? Are the four different offices that you mentioned, are you all completely independent of each other and set your own rules? Is that what you're saying? Or do you have rules that are provided to you by centrally, which you will then follow, and it's just that you are not actually very familiar with what those rules are that have been given to you because you haven't had to follow them yet?
If I understand your question correctly, you meant to say whether we follow the same rules or not. To answer that question is that we have this website, adndrc.org, and there we have the addresses of the four offices. We do follow the same rules, but the complaints go to different offices depending on the user who is using, who is filing the complaint. So we all do use the same rules, but the complaint goes to offices separately.
Gentlemen, these separate offices all affiliated somehow with ADNDRC, do they use the same panelists or do they have different panelists?
We have the same panelists.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry for interrupting, Susan. Did you have further follow-up on your question?
I just wanted to make sure that I'd understood correctly because I was finding the audio is quite muffled. So if I heard you correctly, you were saying you all operate under the same rules, and basically how it works is when a complaint comes in, it gets sent to the most appropriate office depending on location. Is that right?
Yes, correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, Ariel, go ahead.
Thanks, Phil. So if staff heard this correctly, we thought some AIAC doesn't do any URS cases. So I think maybe staff have a good suggestion is maybe to use the most of our time today. Perhaps we can go through the responses from ADNDRC or just the three providers in general and then see whether there's any additional questions that may be raised from their responses, and staff can capture these questions and then we can circle back with the providers at appropriate time. And we're just a little bit concerned if we're asking questions to AIAC representative, but they don't do US cases, they may be not so very helpful for clarifying questions here. So,
I agree, Ariel, and we won't put a burden on the gentleman any further since his office has never handled a URS case. I have to say, as a chair, I think we need some further inquiry into the whole setup because, you know, ICANN has provided one accreditation to ADNDRC. A lot of us were under the impression that these were all four separate offices of that organization. Now we're being told that they're four different organizations, that they don't share experience, and they may even follow different, comply or not comply with the rules differently, which concerns me. So I think we need some further inquiry into that. But I'm going to return now to the questions and answers from ADNDRC, understanding that if we have questions about the responses, the gentleman who's on the phone with us today is not in a position to answer them.
And I see Kathy has raised her hand.
Phil, I agree with everything you just said. This is Kathy. But would it be fair to ask Aditya to answer one more question, which would be, does he know which of the four groups answered these questions? Whose responses this represents?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Hi, Aditya here. So we were sent the format from HKIAC. To name the person, it was Carrie who sent us the response, and she asked us if we want to add anything on her comments. So we generally went through the draft and her answers, and as I previously stated, that we have not administered any URS case till now. So we have very limited experience in that. So our addition was very, very, very limited. Thank you.
So this is Kathy. I'm putting questions in. Can Ariel, it sounds like you know, could you help us understand in the structure? Was Carrie who we met in San Juan. Is she with one of the four offices? Is she with an overseeing office? Does she have a last name? Could you help us with that? Thanks.
Thanks, Kathy. This is Ariel. Yes, Carrie is the person who presented to us in San Juan, and her name is Carrie Xu Sheng from the Hong Kong office. So she was the main person that was responsible for providing all the responses to the questions. And she's unable to join today.
Hey, this is Phil. I lost audio for a minute. I'm back on now. When I lost it, I heard the gentleman saying that the Hong Kong office had prepared the answers, and then Carrie Shang had prepared them, and that the other offices apparently, or at least this one in Kuala Lumpur, had been given an opportunity to review and comment on them. I guess we need to find out, just talking off the top of my head, whether all the ADN-DRC URS cases have been handled out of Hong Kong, or if not, what other offices have handled them, because there seems to be some divergence between practices and a lack of uniformity. But Susan, is that a new hand?
Yeah, thanks, Bill. Yes, it's a new hand. I just wondered, in terms of taking this forward then, I mean, it's nice to have Atiku with us, but of course he should feel free to stay on. But maybe we then shouldn't particularly be focusing on the ADN-DRC responses over any of the other provider responses, because effectively we don't really have anyone that we can direct questions to. So would we be better just looking at the responses from each of the providers on the questions in turn, and just seeing whether they make sense or whether we have any follow-up?
You know, Susan, I think that's a good observation. We had preliminarily agreed to follow the ADN-DRC responses because we thought we had someone on the call with us who could answer questions as we went through them, but that apparently is not the case, and we haven't gone very far in this document, so yeah, I would say why don't we just go across the board and see how all three responded and what differences there are. It might be a more useful exercise and get as far as we can today. Any objection to proceeding in that manner? Okay, hearing none, I'm going to return to actually, give me one moment. I'm in a room with the windows open. It's getting noisier. I'm just going to close the windows and turn on the AC and make it easier for me to talk without background noise. Just give me 20 seconds here. Okay, thank you for that indulgence. So let's return to page 2, and this is communications in ways other than electronically. These are in the procedure, and form response electronic with the notice sent by U.S. mail and fax, which is what the rules require, and if there's a need to, form will communicate by phone if appropriate. Vast majority of correspondence is by email. and MFSD, all communications to complainant by email to the respondent, multiple email addresses as provided, and then just reading through this. And they also, the notice of complaint is also sent by courier, except for post office addresses, and by fax. So of the three providers, Forum and MFSD appear to be following the rules completely, and at least the Hong Kong office of ADNDRC is not. So that's something we were aware of before from our previous conversations. Let me go to the next page. Okay. So this delivery of the complaint.
Sorry, so Kathy raised her
hand. At the top of page 3. Okay, thank you. Kathy, go ahead.
Yeah, Phil, I was wondering if it would be useful to ask staff to highlight sections, like you just noted, where there's something we may know already or may not, but it doesn't appear to jive with what we think the answer might be. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying, there seems to be a disconnect. Would that be useful to have staff maybe highlight that in yellow or some
other
indication?
Well, yeah, if you're in a position to, if staff feels in a position to do that, that would be useful.
Or on
you
the
want them to do that? Are you suggesting they do that as I get to each question or that they guide us through and ask us to focus on the questions where there is divergence?
I'm not sure they've done that already. I'm not sure. I think in some ways you're doing that in real time. But the idea that for future review we might be able to zero in on this very quickly, like a track changes or a yellow highlight, might be useful, because if 90% of it is what we expect, it seems to be consistent with the rules, it's the 10% we're going to want on the next review, or that would be useful for the rest of the working group. I'll pause it. So just some way to note it. And again, a yellow highlight might be a quick way. And we probably won't see it in real time. It'll probably be something we see on the next iteration of the document.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay, good suggestion, Kathy. Let me check the chat room, see if anyone... Oh, and Susan has a hand up, and Justine. So let's hear from them, and then we'll get back to the document. Susan first.
Hi, Susan. I think that seems like a good idea. If I understand Kathy correctly, she's suggesting that if you think there's a kind of rule, you know, divergence issue from the rules, it'd be good for us to kind of have a quick way of spotting it in the table. I think that would be quite useful. But going to that, I think on page 2, the means of communication back and forwards with the registrant, I don't think necessarily that only communicating by email after the complaint is served, I don't think necessarily communicating only by email is a breach of the rules, although, forgive me, I would need to dig out my version of the rules and look at them in detail to remind myself, but I think it's okay. I think there is an issue with this question at the top of page 3, which is about the service of the complaint in the first place. So I think that might be the one we want to highlight. Please, if someone knows the rules better than I do, correct me, because I could be wrong.
Susan, Phil here. Excuse me, Phil here. Now, I think you're correct. I think the URS is designed to be a fast and low-cost process, and everything after sending in a complaint is permitted to be done electronically, very similar to the UDRP, but there is the requirement for the original complaint to be delivered to the registrant through 3 separate means to assure that there is actual receipt and notice of the complaint. So that's been the area of concern. Justine, go ahead, please.
Hi, Justine. On top of what you suggested and supported by Susan, I was just wondering if I could add an extra complication, perhaps. I came across a two-page document sent by staff that contains notes from Professor Tusnet. So, and it's probably just to do with a few items, but I was wondering if staff was going to go through this table with us, they could also be in a position to highlight anything that Professor Tusnet has highlighted that doesn't jive with what we're expecting in terms of answers.
Okay. Thank you for bringing that up, Justine. I'm not sure if I've seen that document. Ariel, is staff aware of the document that Justine is referencing?
Yes, this is Ariel from staff. So Professor Tushnet's comments are all incorporated in the additional notes column in the spreadsheet. And also I will put a link in the chat. That's where all the individual submissions are uploaded. That includes the two-page document from Professor Tushnet, and that's the second last document on that spreadsheet on that page. Because there's so many documents being circulated, we thought probably the best is to put everything on this wiki page and people can go through them if they want to individually, but this spreadsheet consolidates all the information in one place. So we thought this may be more efficient to look at just focus on this spreadsheet.
Yeah, so I'm seeing very few additional notes in the Adobe document that was sent out yesterday.
Yes, that's correct. And actually, sorry for interrupting. Professor Tushnet only provided input to, I think, 4 questions. There are only 7 sent to her that staff identified that her data may help respond or answer these questions, but her comment only concerns with 4 of them. So that's why it's not a lot of additional notes.
All right, then let's just keep going through the document as best we can. So it's just too confusing to go from the chat room to an Adobe document to a Google document. It's not really feasible on a call. At least not for this person.
I'm sorry, so I think Justin has her hand raised. Not sure if it's old or new.
All right. Well, again, I'm looking at my Adobe document, so I'm out of the chat room because I can't read the document in the chat room. Go ahead. I don't see a hand up.
She just lowered it.
Yeah, that was an old hand. All right, let's get back to this. So, at the top of page 3, we know that ADN-DRC, at least ADN-DRC Hong Kong, does not do the fax or hard copy. The forum response, I'm not going to read all of this. We can all read this, and we'll be here forever if I'm reading every word. So they send email notice of the complaint to all the available email addresses. And they follow up if a privacy shield is lifted with an additional email. And they don't use any additional means to confirm receipt. They do save all rejected emails and a log of failed faxes and scans all returned mail. So they're following the rules, and they are keeping records of when there appears to be a failure of delivery through any of the 3 methods. MFSD sends a electronic copy of notice of complaint to the respondent to all the email addresses shown in WHOIS. and we're going to put the GDPR considerations aside for this call, since they are a issue of great focus within ICANN, and we don't know how that that's going to be resolved right now, or whether UDRS and UDRP providers are starting to experience difficulties because of GDPR. That might be something we can discuss in Panama when we have more folks with us. They send a hard copy by courier, and except for PO addresses, and a registered letter of return receipt, and by fax, if that's available in the WHO is. They track the delivery through return receipt for emails, online tracking available at courier's website, return receipt for registered letters, and transmission verification for fax. That seems about as comprehensive as you can get. Communicate notice of lock to the email addresses shown on the website. And they give the respondent a way to get the complaint and annexes at an alternative email address if they wish to. And if they use a language different from English, they translate a hard copy of the model response translated into that language is also sent along with the notice of complaint. So MFSD seems to have the most comprehensive method of ensuring delivery of the complaint. It appears to me, I'd have to look back at the rules, that they may be going above and beyond the rules to some extent, and there's nothing wrong with that. Let's go on to 2G. Let me check the Adobe room. Okay, no hands up. And rule 2G, do you conform to communications timeline? ADNDRC says yes. Forum says yes. There's some information there about additional contact information made available for the respondent after the notice of complaint email is sent. They calculate the response due date from the date of the initial email, but they inform the respondent of the response due date in the subsequent correspondence. And MFSD just says yes. So generally yes across the board there. Any comments on that one? Okay, URS technical requirements, registry requirement 5. Do you receive notifications from registry operators via email regarding the completion of URS actions? ADN says yes. Usually registry operators return inquiries quickly, but there are some cases that take longer. Forum says yes. They receive notifications with verification and locking confirmation. They sometimes receive confirmation of registry operators regarding suspension. So always on the lock, sometimes on suspension. I'd have to look back at the rules to see if that's fully compliant on the part of the registry. And MFSD says, yes, they do receive notification from the registry regarding lock and the implementation of the URS determination. So they are getting notices of suspension or rollback regularly. Sometimes they don't get responsive within 24 hours, in which case they send reminder emails. And they note that they also have the possibility to submit a report to ICANN for lack of completion on the part of the registry operator. Uh, and they've done that a couple of times when they haven't gotten confirmation on the requested URS action, which I assume would generally be suspension. So that's something to keep in mind. There seems to be some... My impression from those answers is that the registries are doing a good job on providing notice of the lock, but there's some problems with notice of the follow-up suspension when there's an adverse determination for the respondent. All right, so moving on to page 4. URS technical requirements to receive notification via email from the registry. If a locked or suspended domain has been deleted or purged, if the registration of a locked or suspended domain has expired, and if the URS suspended domain has been renewed for an additional year, ADNDRC says yes to all three. Forum says they've got 637 instances, which my recollection would not be all the cases they've done, and they're going to provide supplemental information in Panama. MFSD says no, basically, they haven't gotten any of these notifications. So I'd say generally we're seeing some evidence of some issues with registries not complying with the sending the notice that they've locked the domain, but there are gaps in the follow-up notices. Next one, technical registry requirement 7. You receive information from ICANN with regard to the point of control at the back-end registry operator appointed by a registry operator. ADNDRC says, to our knowledge, we don't. Forum says yes. We get one with, and then they list the fields that they get. And MFSD says, since it's approval, it's been provided with credentials to access ICANN's repository and download the registry operator's contacts periodically, and that they get monthly updates by email. So some divergence in answers there. Question from the document subteam. Have you experienced difficulties in communicating with a registry operator in respect to their role in any part of a URS proceeding? ADNDRC says no. Usually no, but some registries take longer to get back. Forum says they encounter some difficulty and delay in getting responses to verification and lock requests from some registries, likely because there are so few URS cases, so they have a conjecture that is due to lack of familiarity with the URS on the part of registries, and that if the parties settle, there's some difficulty getting the registry and the registrar on the same page to implement a settlement, which typically involves a transfer at the registrar level. That's interesting that we're learning that some URS cases are settled with domain transfers, even though domain transfer is not a result of a completed URS case. I guess the parties are free to settle in any manner they wish. That's just... I'm just noting the information. MFSD says their communications are smooth, cordial, and collaborative. Well, that's positive. But then they say in a few cases they faced a number of difficulties, and then they lay them out. So some registries didn't know that MFSD was a provider. Some communicate from email addresses different from the contacts present in ICANN's repository, which creates a problem with the PGP key. They've had to send reminder emails in a few cases, and in a few cases they've had to send reminder emails to but one on the lock and two on the suspension. So generally okay, but some glitches. I'm going to check the chat room. Okay. Susan, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. I wonder if this point that MFSD are making about use of different email addresses is perhaps something we maybe should follow up. I'm not quite sure where. It might be we need to follow it up within ICANN rather than with them. And it may, there may not be an issue here, but I'm just thinking about my own or my colleagues' communications generally and about the database and the records that ICANN has had, certainly in the past, on things like, say, billing contacts and so on. And for some reason, you know, the contacts that ICANN uses for billing queries are quite often woefully out of date, even though new contact details have been provided. And so I'm just wondering if there's some kind of an internal ICANN issue in terms of ensuring that the right email addresses and the up-to-date email addresses are getting communicated through to the providers. I think it's something we should at least, it's worth at least a question, I think.
Yeah, I would agree, Susan. I don't think it raises any policy issues. The policy seems to be clear and not that difficult. It seems to be a clerical or technical issue that should be addressed now that we're aware of it. And it probably ICANN is the one. If they've got out-of-date email information, that's not a particularly difficult fix, but it ought to be addressed. So I think we're in agreement on that one. So now I believe I'm at the top of page 4 of 32, so we're certainly not going to finish this document today, which means we'll all have time to actually go through it before the next call discussing it, and we will be devoting attention to this in a dedicated session in Panama, in which we will have more complete responses we expect at that time. So URS technical registry requirement number 6, do you receive notification via email from the registry operators? We've already gone through this one, I think. Yeah. Next one, registry requirement 7. Now, where are we? So we're finished with page 4.
Still, pardon me. Yes, that's right. We're top.
Pardon me, just getting a little confused jumping from chat room to document. So now on page 5, we're on Rule 3A and B and Form Supplemental Rule 4B. Yes?
Justin has her hand raised.
Go ahead, Justin.
Sorry, Phil, didn't mean to preempt you. At the item that you raised now that we're discussing, I just had a question for Aditya. Could you remind us how the ADNBRC actually receives complaints? Is it by email or through an online form? Thanks.
Could I how ADNBRC does what with the complaint? Sorry, you broke up a little.
Sure, I'll just repeat my question. It's for Aditya, actually. My question was, could Aditya remind us, or at least me, how does ADNBRC actually receive complaints? Is it via email or via an online form?
Hi, Aditya here. So we receive the complaint by online forms. Thank you.
Okay. So I think that relates to this question at the top of page 5 regarding do you accept complaints that do not contain all the elements required in Rule 3B. Please provide your online forms and identify any deviation from Rule 3B. ADNDRC simply says, yes, one copy of the complaint form has been attached. They don't indicate any deviation, although they're silent on that issue, whether it's completely conforming or there are some deviations. Forum says, and I'm a little bit confused, I got to say, by the ADNDRC response, which seems to be, yes, they accept incomplete complaints, seems to be the answer, which raises a question since I don't believe they're supposed to. The forum response is no. The forum's online filing portal will not accept a complaint that does not conform to 3B. Complainants do have the ability to upload additional documents with or behind the required three documents for each domain name if the size limitation allows. They leave it to the examiner to either accept or ignore the additional documents. And then they refer us to an online location for their online filing form. And MFSD says, no, our online complaint form is accessible. And I believe the no is to the question, do you accept incomplete applications? And then they explain what's in the different sections of their form. And then they throw in some information. I'm just scrolling down here so I can read all of this. Give me a moment here. Now, this is interesting. Starting from 25 May 2018, effective date of the GDPR and the temporary spec approved by ICANN's board, they accept URS complaints even if the complainant does not provide the contact details of the respondent, a so-called DOE complainant, because they're not available in the public accessible who is or not otherwise known to the complainant. And so they've modified their form to accept one that's incomplete in that regard because of the initiation of GDPR enforcement and the temporary specification, which those of us who have looked at it know that it has two provisions specifically allowing the filing of so-called DOE complaints for UDRP and URS. So it'd be useful to check with the other two providers, and I'm not surprised to see this from MFSD because they are located in an EU country. It might be useful to follow up with Forum and ADNDRC to see if they've modified anything to adhere to the changed circumstances resulting from GDPR.
So this
okay.
Is Ariel. We have Justine and
Susan. I see hands, yes. I see Justine and then Susan. Go ahead, Justine.
Yes, hi. Thanks, Phil. Justine speaking. I was just curious. I mean, you brought up the point in terms of the question I was going to ask, and I'm not sure whether IDK is in a position to answer this because, you know, he speaks only for one office. If you do, based on the answer that Carrie has provided, or ADN, DRC has provided, that they do accept complaints and not complete, so to speak. What do they do with the incomplete complaint? That's the question I want to know. Or that's the question I would like to pose back to the group. Thanks.
Is there any response from the gentleman from Kuala Lumpur?
Hi, Adedeyo. I think this question would be best answered by, again, HKIAC, which has administered the URS cases. So I'm not in a position to answer this question.
Okay, thank you. Susan, go ahead with your question or its comment.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, it's very similar to Justine's, in fact. But I just, this was reminding me of the session that we had in Puerto Rico, and I got the sense that sometimes, you know, one person's yes on this document was another person's no. So I think a follow-up question to ADNDRC would be very beneficial because, as I say, I just, on certain of the questions that we asked, when we had the presentations from people, I actually got the sense that, you know, they may be saying yes because they accept the incomplete complaint, but then, you know, it maybe gets rejected, whereas someone else would be answering that as no because they would reject it. Do you know what I mean? So it's basically Justine's question, like, so if you take an incomplete complaint, what do you do? Because I think we may discover that actually they're all kind of on the same page, and it's just about process.
Yeah, I agree, Susan. I think we need to follow up with ADNDRC to burrow down and get into the weeds on what this yes response means. Obviously, incomplete complaints are not supposed to be accepted if the definition of accepted is that you're going to move forward and send a notice to the registrant that a process has been started. If it just means that they accept it and then reject it, that's a different story. So that we need to find out, and I think we, based on that very helpful response from MFSD, we ought to be asking the other two providers whether they've adjusted their systems to accept DOE complaints in regard to any complaints that may be filed against particularly EU-based registrants who WHOIS information may no longer be available after 25th of May. So, and we can do that leading into Panama and see if we can get some responses there. All right, so I don't see any other hands up. So I'm going to move on to page 6. All right. And do you ask for any additional information in the complaint beyond what's required in the URS rules? And if so, please provide the relevant provision of your supplemental rules. And all three say no. So we can dispose of that one. They just ask for what's required and nothing further. So the next one, okay. Let's start with the easy one to ANDRC. Does your electronic complaint form allow the uploading of SMD files in the same manner as MFSD? And they say, yes, we allow the upload. And then there's a more complex question posed to forum. How do you handle the submission of a relevant SMD proof of use from the TMCH? And then there's an explanation for that. Are you able to read the encoded information? What parts of that information are made available to examiners, complainants, and respondents in the proceeding? So we've got a long answer from URS. They accept SMD files as proof of use. They're uploaded just as any other proof of evidence would be on the filing portal, and it's available for viewing by both the respondent and complainant and examiner. They automatically open as text files. On occasion, examiners request that the forum save the text files as a PDF and email them to the examiner. They contain only 5 lines of readable text, marks. I'm not going to go through all of these, but the remainder of the file is encoded and cannot be read. In April 2018, forum was given credentials with the assistance of ICANN to confirm that the SMD file submitted are still valid, but we would hope that they would only accept valid SMD files. And they did not specifically reference SMD files in Annex A because of the URS rule specifically mentioned SMDs as an acceptable file type. And they received 252 SMD files in the URS cases as of June 8th, which is just 5 days ago. So a lot of information there. Any comments on anything there from anyone on the call? And Kathy, I'm not surprised to see your hand up because I know this was an issue of interest to you.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Thanks. And I was wondering if we could add to the notes kind of a flag here that the forum seems to have confirmed, and I appreciate their lengthy response, seems to have confirmed that most of the data in the SMD file is difficult to read, remains encoded, and so that we should check further on questions about the jurisdiction from which the trademark registration comes, the category of goods and services, whether the examiners have that data in front of them. It looks like some examiners request the form save the text file as a PDF, the text file, I guess, of the SMD file. But that doesn't necessarily unencrypt the remainder of the data. So if we could add to the notes, questions about the jurisdiction of the trademark and the categories of goods and services of the trademark, and continue to kind of zero in on that a little bit. Thanks.
Yeah, and we can certainly do that, Kathy. And Susan, please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. I think the SMB file is only the proof of use, isn't it? It doesn't supersede the need to identify the trademark. I think it may warrant a follow-up question, but I think that's the point, that the SMB file is only about demonstrating that proof of use has been provided.
Yeah, that may well be the case, Susan, and certainly from what forum's response, it appears that the categories of goods and services remain encoded and cannot be read, so that would have to be in the actual text of the complaint. So I'm going to note here, let me see if there's any other hands up as I jump from document to room. All right, so we are at 8:19 after the hour. Let's see what's on the next page. Maybe we'll do one more page and call it a morning. And this pretty complex response, so let's go through this one and then talk about where we go after this initial and partial review. So let's go through page 7 here. Hold on. Okay. Sorry, I've got that thing where the page keeps moving even though I don't want it to. All right, now it's stopped. URS procedure 1263. Question. What other circumstances not included in the non-exclusive list in the URS procedure 1263 have led your examiner to determine that the domain name was registered and being used in bad faith? Had there been cases where examiners have not expressly cited a circumstance as a basis of their finding of demonstrable bad faith registration and use? ADNDRC says no. So they're saying there's been no other circumstances. I guess they're saying no to both questions. It's not two no. There's two separate questions here, but they've given us a single no. Forum has reached out to examiners and hopes to supplement their response at Panama. And MFSD has a lengthy response. I have to say their response has been quite helpful in their comprehensive nature. I want to commend them publicly for that. They say the examiners take into consideration the totality of the circumstances. Some have found that in addition to the circumstances expressly mentioned. The following were also to be considered as indicia of bad faith registration and use. So let's go through this list. Respondent's use of false contact details. Respondent's failure to provide any evidence of bona fide registration and use in the response. Respondent's failure to submit any response and provide any evidence of bona fide registration and use. I guess since we know most URS cases are default cases, that would cover a lot of them. Factors, respondent has changed the website content associated with disputed domain name after receiving the letter of the complainant's lawyer, and they've redirected the name to another website. Respondent's passive holding the domain name in combination with the fact that the respondent has registered a vast number of domain names incorporating well-known trademarks and the same new GTLD. I have to note here that I've been raising the issue in the cases we've seen where decisions have been made for bad faith use against dark websites, whether that was an application of the passive holding doctrine, which I think would be acceptable if it was articulated. And this is the first time I've seen that the words passive holding in any response from a provider. So I'm happy to see that. You know, my personal view would be, and we'll discuss this in the working group, that a minimum element would be saying, you know, in a decision, not just I find the elements to be met, but I find them to be met for this reason or these reasons, and take the extra minute to set them out. So that's a personal comment. Continuing, respondent's constructive knowledge of the complainant's trademark, adult content present at the website associated with the disputed domain name, respondent's failure to reply to cease and desist letters of the complainant, and there's no cases where examiners have not expressly cited a circumstance as a basis of finding. So MFSD is saying that all of their examiners have always stated, have always provided a rationale for a finding of bad faith registration and use. I commend them for that personally. And they've given us quite a list of other indicia of bad faith registration and use, which are not explicitly in the rules, but I think we're all familiar with these various concepts if we're familiar with UDRP case law. So anybody have any comments on that? That was quite a meaty response. Okay, so continuing on, AD&D, DRC question. Has any complainant expressed any difficulty with the 500-word limit set for the complaint? Now, AD&DRC says no. Forum says, MFSD says no. Forum, which has done the most cases, say they have received complaints that 500 words was insufficient. I think we ought to follow up with them and, you know, see if anyone suggested what the length should be. This is not designed to be a process with as many words as the UDRP, since it's for black and white cases. But we can look at that issue as we move on to policy decisions. And the last question on this page to AD&DRC and Forum, do you check to determine whether a document that's cited in a new URS complaint is already subject to an open and active URS or UDRP proceeding? And if so, how do you find this information? AD&D says, yes, by conducting cross-checks. I'd be wondering what they check against. We can follow up on that. Forum relies heavily upon the representations made by the complainant, but conducts searches if there's a suspicion that the domain name is subject to a pending URS or UDRP. I'd be curious what would trigger such a suspicion. And MFSD, let's just go through their response. During their administrative review, they verify the complainant's declaration, and they carry out manually an online research at the URS and UDRP providers' websites for URS and UDRP cases. So they actually go the extra mile and check in every case against all the providers' websites. You know, I think one issue we can look at for URS, and then, you know, when we get to UDRP next year, the same issue would arise, was whether there ought to be one place maybe maintained by ICANN that lists all pending cases and all decisions from all the providers, so folks don't have to go to multiple places to get that information, particularly now that there's two different procedures and a multiplicity of providers, some of whom do URS and some do UDRP. That's just a personal view, and we can have a discussion on that in the working group. So it's 27 after the hour. We're going to stop there rather than go on to the next page. I want to apologize for the rocky start of this call. But again, I was working, when I checked my actual calendar notices, I was working off a calendar notice that said we'd be discussing Professor Tushnet's research, and in the rush of emails yesterday, I simply missed the one that had the Adobe document with the provider responses attached, and hadn't gone through it in advance of this call, because if the calendar notice had said we're going through providers' responses, I would have said, gee, where are those? I better find them. But that's not what it said. Nonetheless, I think we made some progress today. I don't know that we're going to be able to get through all the provider responses before Panama. Staff, what is our plan for further review of these responses prior to being together in Panama? That is for the sub-team to have an opportunity to review them, and if there's not enough time based on 90 minutes to go through one quarter of the response, let's posit we could have gone through at least 8 pages if we hadn't been a little flummoxed at the beginning of this call. Can staff go through prior to the next call and identify the questions for which we've gotten divergent answers from the different providers? So, Ariel, go ahead.
Thanks, Phil. Just a very quick comment. So the confusion may be caused because our Secretary of team may have pulled some information about previous discussion what's going to be on today's call. So you saw it's talking about Professor Tushnet's data, but the actual agenda was not about that. So we'll make sure to correct that in the future, and so we are communications in sync and not to confuse people. And if I may I ask Julie to chime in about the next step?
Yeah, do we have other, I guess my specific question is, do we have other calls for this provider sub-team scheduled between now and Panama?
Hi, Phil. This is Julie Hedlund from staff. No, we have no.
Hi, Julie.
Hi. We have no other calls scheduled for this group. We can certainly try.
What day is that scheduled for?
No, I said, I'm sorry, maybe not very clear. We have no other call scheduled
for. We have no other call.
No. At this time, we do have sessions at ICANN 62 set aside for the practitioners and the providers sub-team.
Right.
Those were for presentations, but they also could be working sessions, and that's something the co-chairs could consider. Or we can consider trying to schedule also a call next week and do a doodle so that perhaps we could capture a time at which the providers might be able to join us.
Yeah, let me, Susan, I see your hand up. I'm going to call on you in a second. You know, I'm reluctant to schedule yet another call. We have such a heavy call schedule in this working group over the next week. Maybe we need one. Maybe we can find the time for one. I'm going to suggest that we get an email, ask staff to prepare an email to the full membership of this sub-team indicating that we reviewed the responses through the bottom of page 7. We've identified some things we want to follow up with. You can pull those from the notes Some of them are AD&D or C-specific. Some of them are general, like have the providers adjusted their forms to accept DOE filings in the wake of GDPR, and ask staff to go through the document and point out to members, and this wouldn't have to be an initial email. It could be later in the week. Answers where staff has found significant divergence between the responses we're getting from the providers, and then we can follow up by email and then decide by the end of the week whether we need one more sub-team call before we all gather together in Panama. That's my thinking. Let me turn to Susan and get her thinking.
Thanks, Phil. Yeah, thanks, Phil. I'm extremely reluctant to try and set another sub-team call in during, you know, before we go to Panama. I know it doesn't affect everyone, but there are some of us who are also on the Sunrise and Claim data sub-team, and as you well know, Phil, you know, we've got extensive time allocated to that during the rest of this week and next week. And frankly, you know, the RPM's working group is becoming a full-time job, and it's just not feasible in the small time we have left running up to Panama to fit more calls in on this. I know, you know, the plan was that this subgroup was going to be presenting to the wider working group, but I don't think we should be allowing a face-to-face meeting to truncate our time or force us to speed things up and put in calls which we don't have time to schedule and which people don't have time to attend. So, I mean, maybe we could actually use our time in Panama productively to keep going with this work. Maybe?
Yeah, I agree, Susan. By the way, I see a question from Kathy. Can we bill ICANN for our time? Kathy, I think the follow-up question would be whether ICANN can file for bankruptcy, because I think that would be the result of doing that, even at minimal billing, when one considers all the amount of unpaid labor contributed by ICANN volunteers, some of whom are being paid by someone else, but it's still a value to ICANN and the community. So let's do this. To reiterate what I said, let's send out a follow-up email today. Staff can prepare it and send it out, noting to all members of the sub-team that we had this call, that we got through the end of page 7. Take from the notes the follow-up actions and questions we've identified so far, and ask everyone to please review, take an hour to review the document if you're on this sub-team, so we don't have to do another call. Provide any feedback by email by the end of the week if there are responses that raise further questions or concern anyone. That staff by the end of the week will do their own review and identify for the members anywhere where they note divergence in the answers by the providers to when we should be getting similar responses to these questions. And finally, I would ask staff to let us know, to let the sub-team members know, if we're going to have representatives from the three providers with us in Panama. And I guess with AD&DRC, we have found out today that they have four separate organizations under that umbrella. All the URS cases seem to be done by the Hong Kong office, and they're the only one in a position to provide responses, and which raises some interesting questions, but whether we're going to have someone from Hong Kong office with us in Panama. So any objections to proceeding that way? All right, seeing none, hearing none, I thank everyone for being on this call. We did get the full 90 minutes plus a few in. Apologies again for the confusion, but I don't know, other people prepare for the next day, but before I leave the office each day, I look at my calendar for the next day and to see what's coming up and to make sure I've done some homework for whatever's coming up. And I had assumed we were discussing Professor Tushnet's data survey today and not this document, that explains the confusion. But we made some progress. We've identified some issues for follow-up, and I thank you for your time, and you are free to continue your day unless, like some of us, you're on another RPM call later today. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Please remember to disconnect all lines and have a wonderful rest of your day.
The host has left.